Last month, officials from several countries met in Kingston, Jamaica, to discuss the perils of deep sea mining. Some mining companies have argued that deep sea mining is necessary to facilitate electrification. That claim has been debunked by several scientists, and environmental campaigners are saying that not only would this obviously harm marine ecosystems, it might be a total disaster for the climate. I'm joined today by a campaigner who's been working on this topic for a while with the Environmental Justice Foundation to explain what this meeting was about, what's up with deep sea mining, and why it might be a huge climate disaster, amongst other things. That's coming up after this quick break. This is Drilled, and I'm Amy Westervelt.
My name's Lara Shira-White, and I'm a campaigner in resource extraction and ecosystem security for the Environmental Justice Foundation.
I know this story goes back much farther than this meeting in Jamaica, but could you start by telling me what this meeting was and what the sort of goal of it was supposed to be?
Yeah, absolutely. The July meeting of the International Seabed Authority was the meeting of the body that is responsible for governing deep sea mining in international waters specifically. So this meeting was really important because of something called the two-year rule, which is a legal loophole, which I'll get to in a moment. But just for some background on the ISA, it's made up of 167 states plus the EU, and this meeting took place in Kingston, Jamaica. It had a really specific goal, and this was brought on by something called the two-year rule. So this was triggered in July 2021 when the island state of Nauru announced its intention to start mining the seabed in international waters. There has been no commercial mining happening up to this point, apart from kind of pilot and test studies. But what happens when a country announces its intention to mine under the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea is that it kind of starts the clock on a two-year deadline for the International Seabed Authority to agree on rules and regulations to allow deep sea mining. And essentially, if it doesn't do that in that time, the loophole says that it allows mining to start anyway. So when Nauru announced its intention to mine in July 2021, it started the clock to July 2023. And of course, this is a terrifying loophole because it implies that deep sea mining could take place without environmental regulations in place. So this meeting was really important. It was an opportunity for states to get together and address, you know, what do we do about this legal loophole? Do we allow deep sea mining to take place? Do we implement a moratorium? Do we stop it from going ahead? How do we deal with the fact that regulations are not in place yet? So that's kind of an overview on why the meeting was important.
Can you walk us through why deep sea mining has become such a focal point in the last, say, 5 years in general?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is that the rush to mine the seabed has really been pushed by industry, and it's really been industry behind this kind of this two-year rule pressure as well. And the industry argument for deep sea mining is very much linked to the green transition, which makes it kind of a controversial topic politically in a way, because these companies are claiming that the critical minerals that we need for green transition technologies, including kind of renewable technologies, but critically like electric vehicle batteries, their claim is that we can't meet demand for these minerals without deep sea mining. And so they're saying that deep sea mining is a necessity of the green transition. But of course, then you've got this enormous opposition from a really broad spectrum of society, encompassing obviously civil society like us, but also scientists, entire states, and critically businesses and financial institutions who are saying, no, we don't accept this argument and we're not going to support deep sea mining. Businesses saying that they will not use deep sea minerals in their supply chains, including some of the biggest car manufacturers in the world like BMW and Volvo, because deep sea mining is attached to so much environmental damage and really importantly, some really massive gaps in our scientific knowledge on what that damage is going to look like exactly. The deep sea kind of underpins the stability of our ocean. We've explored maybe less than 1% of the deep sea, and yet it covers a huge expanse of the Earth's surface. And it remains very much a mystery to us in terms of its biodiversity. But every single expedition that goes down to the seafloor and covers these incredible species that have, most of which have never been seen before. And we are talking about some of the most incredible species that we've seen, and certainly some of the oldest species we've ever seen, including, you know, corals kind of 11,000 years old, which, you know, to put that in perspective, is about, I think, 7,000 years before woolly mammoths finally disappeared from the Earth's surface. There is a Greenland shark swimming around in the deep sea, which could have been alive kind of in Henry VIII's times. I mean, just we're talking about really, really incredible species, most of which have never been seen before and also which haven't been found anywhere else in the world. A recent study compiled a list of over 5,500 species that scientists have documented living in the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, which is an area very sought after by deep sea mining industry. And 92% of those species identified are completely new to science, and only 6 of them have been seen elsewhere. And these habitats that this biodiversity depends on take millennia to form, literally millennia to form, and just a couple of years deep sea mining operations to destroy. So we're talking about damage that would be irreparable on human timescales, and extinctions of species that possibly we haven't even discovered yet too. And then I guess on top of that as well, you've also got really quite unknown but potentially very severe climate impacts. The ocean is the world's largest carbon sink. It absorbs huge amounts of carbon from our atmosphere. And a lot of this is stored in marine sediments. And deep sea marine sediments make up 80% of all of the carbon stored in ocean marine sediments. And so when you are talking about deep sea mining, you know, there are several different types of deep sea mining, but all of them impose severe disruption on deep sea ecosystems. So, you know, you're kind of talking about carbon that has been stored in these sediments for millennia being disrupted and kind of put back into the oceanic carbon cycle. And we don't really know what will happen if that carbon reaches the surface, but, you know, certainly it could absolutely worsen the climate crisis, which is completely contradictory to the intentions that the deep sea mining industry claim to have, which is to help the climate crisis. You know, helping the climate crisis by mining an ecosystem and potentially worsening global heating is kind of like fighting fire with fire.
How would you answer the claim that mining companies are making that, you know, there's no way that we can meet the demand for battery powered everything without deep sea mining? I've written a lot about this idea that if we just sort of keep everything exactly the same but electrify it, this sort of avoids dealing with consumption and the car centricity of many places. Is it a question of that, or is it just patently false that even at like the highest levels of consumption that this wouldn't necessarily be needed?
I think you raise a really good point about consumption, first of all, because we know that based on kind of the consumption of rich industrialized countries, like the UK, like Germany, for example, we would need 3 planet Earths to sustain our resource needs. And what's really important to note about deep sea mining is that it helps to kind of perpetuate this endless consumption until we start reducing how many critical minerals we use, till we start properly implementing a circular economy and improving our recycling. We're always going to need more minerals. And so what you're talking about is kind of just pushing our Earth further and further and further until it can't stand it anymore, and just destroying our environment more and more and more. But also what's really important to note is that claim that terrestrial mining can't meet resource demand and that circular economy can't reach resource demand has literally been debunked by some of Europe's leading scientists at the European Academy Science Advisory Council in this report that they released very recently, which categorically said that this narrative put forward by deep sea mining companies is misleading and supports the calls from the European Commission and other countries for a moratorium. You know, we can make huge reductions in the demand for critical minerals by improving recycling rates. And also really importantly to note, by using technologies that we have available to us right now, it's possible to achieve an 80% recovery rate for lithium, which is currently around 1%, which is shocking, for cobalt, which is around 32 to 74%, and nickel 57% and manganese 53%, potential recovery rates between 90 to 95%. And this is using technology that is available now, you know, so while we're, it's just quite nonsensical to pursue further and further mining, particularly deep sea mining, unleashing this really harmful activity on a completely new, previously untouched and pristine area of the planet, when we're wasting all of this potential by not recycling our materials properly. And this equates to huge financial losses as well. In 2019, the raw materials contained in Europe's electronic waste were around $12.9 billion, and then $14.2 billion for the Americas, with North America generating the largest proportion of this e-waste. That's huge losses. And I think another thing to note is that obviously we have these really high projections for mineral demand put forward by the International Energy Agency. And of course, you know, these are really important. But something important to note is that they don't necessarily take into account developments in battery technology as well. You know, projections for battery technology developments are kind of increasing. The market share of batteries which require neither cobalt nor nickel rose to 31% in September 2022 from 17% in 2021. And so these projections, while, you know, we can't necessarily depend on them, they do present a lot of potential to reduce demand for these certain critical minerals which deep sea mining operations seek to exploit.
It's so interesting. Could you address the sort of the justice angle as well? I was reading about the contract that Nauru has with this mining company in Canada, and reminds me so much of what oil companies do in what they call frontier territories as well, where, you know, they just kind of very quickly capture the government and exert an enormous amount of control. And the sell is always that this developing country is going to get rich off of this thing, and it never seems to really happen. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, and how this sort of just like repeats a lot of the same colonial patterns we've seen in other types of extraction.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really important dimension of it. I mean, I think something important to note about the way that deep sea mining kind of works is that for an exploitation license, it has to have a sponsoring state. A company has to have a sponsoring state in order to mine the seabed. And so you frequently have these big corporations based in the global north using a state like Nauru, like a Pacific Island state, as its sponsoring state. And it is presented as kind of like a really big opportunity for this state. But ultimately, if the company is based in the global north and that's where they're paying tax, it's really hard to see what the economic benefit is of this. And also, you know, you then have kind of questions surrounding liability, like who's responsible if something goes wrong and who deals with the fallout when something does go wrong. I think a really good example of this is in 2011, Nautilus Minerals, which is, again, a Canadian-owned company, as is the Metals Company, which is the company that has the license sponsored by Nauru. They were granted a deep-sea mining license by Papua New Guinea for mining in the country's own waters. And this project went ahead, but it collapsed into insolvency in 2019. And this meant that Papua New Guinea ended up losing out on around $120 million, which equates to around a third of the country's annual health budget, or almost a third. A really important point of this is that actually the people who deal with the fallout in these countries frequently are the people who have nothing to do with this at all. We're talking about communities who depend on the ocean for their livelihoods, who have cultural ties to the ocean. You know, for example, in Papua New Guinea, shark calling is used as a traditional method of fishing. And fishers in Papua New Guinea are still reporting that you know, this traditional practice has been damaged by the deep sea mining operations because of the noise and the disruption that the deep sea mining caused. They say has scared away the sharks, and they haven't come back. We see there are some interesting ties between this case and what's going on currently, because Gerard Barron, who was one of the individuals behind Nautilus Minerals, has now moved to the Canada-based The Metals Company, which is behind the license sponsored by Nauru, which has triggered the two-year rule. So I think it's really critical that we ask these kinds of questions about who benefits, because the answer is that it's not the communities in these countries who depend on the ocean. It's going to be big corporations, mostly in the global north. And I think we'll just see this environmental injustice that we see already in so many different sectors and different industries just being perpetuated in a new form.
From the reporting that I've read on the meeting in Jamaica, China has been a big proponent of getting deep sea mining going. What are the countries that are pushing for more caution here?
China's absolutely pro deep sea mining. We also have Norway, the UK. I wouldn't say that they're like massive proponents, but they're not. They haven't announced moratorium. They have licenses. They have interest. Norway has opened up areas of its own continental shelf to deep sea mining already. And then on the other side of things, we have this huge movement for a moratorium, and it's not big enough yet, and we need way more countries, but it is accelerating. Like, this wave of opposition is growing significantly. So for calling for moratorium, we've got the Federated States of Micronesia, Canada, New Zealand, Switzerland, Samoa, Palau, Fiji, among others, precautionary pause, Costa Rica, Chile, France have called for a ban. We've also got Germany, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, Finland, all coming out with positions against deep sea mining. But this is really accelerating very fast. In the couple of months alone, the number of countries that have added their voices to this opposition is really incredible. Over one weekend alone, Brazil, Portugal, and Finland added their names to this group of countries in July. So we really do see that country opposition is growing. There is real urgency among states to throw their hat in the ring and say, no, we really shouldn't be doing this. And it's really, really heartening. Obviously, the more the better, because deep sea mining has to be stopped before it starts. But we are really seeing like a lot of momentum building now.
Is there any kind of regulation that would be palatable to folks, or are people pushing for a moratorium in general on deep sea mining, given just how many potential problems it poses?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the environmental impacts of deep sea mining being as great as they are, it's very difficult to see a way in which any kind of environmental regulations could be drafted that would be effective enough to present harm to the seafloor. You know, the bottom line is that this shouldn't go ahead at all. It's unnecessary. It will create long-lasting irreparable damage. And, you know, I'm just reiterating the first point here, but it's not needed. So where is the sense in this? So if absolutely, the solution is a moratorium. And it's a moratorium that is assessed regularly, but, you know, after time-bound and with really, really rigorous kind of scientific evaluation of the science. And as long as the science is saying this is going to cause irreparable, long-lasting damage on a huge scale, deep sea mining shouldn't go ahead. It is as simple as that. Because I think at the end of the day is that, you know, you're talking about destroying habitat. You're talking about destroying habitat that would take centuries to recover from. And it's also important to note that actually deep sea mining companies, they have explored kind of ideas of like, oh, maybe we could restore the marine environment. But a really crucial report coming from Planet Tracker, I think last month or the month before, found that this is just financially completely unfeasible, even without going into questions of whether it would actually be effective. You're talking about removing habitat. It's like, even if something isn't living on a polymetallic nodule one day, which is, you know, what would be mined, a polymetallic nodule, even if there isn't a sponge in it one day, doesn't mean that a sponge won't be on it tomorrow. And so as long as you're taking habitat away from these deep sea ecosystems, the ecosystems will be harmed. When it's not necessary and it's going to cause damage like that, it should just never go ahead.
What are you watching out for coming out of this meeting in Jamaica and leading up to whatever the next meeting is?
So the ISA meeting that just happened in Kingston, deep sea mining was not given the green light, which obviously companies are pushing for. So it's a real win in that sense. And country opposition is really strong and it's growing, which is great. But, you know, we're not out of the danger zone, because a lot of countries are saying we will not submit an application to mine the seabed until we have environmental regulations in place. That was the general decision from the ISA meeting. But the statements from countries saying that they won't do this, they're not necessarily legally binding. And so technically, a company could submit an application to mine the seabed currently. And that is a really dangerous position to be in. And we saw an announcement from the metals company just last week saying that they do intend to mine the seabed and they intend to submit an application after the July 2024 meeting, which is kind of the meeting where, you know, supposedly these regulations might get adopted. In reality, it's quite unlikely that regulations will be adopted by July 2024, just because they take so long to kind of develop and agree upon. And so I think what we really need to be on the lookout for is an application to mine the seabed. We have to be on our guard, and it's crucial that for this reason that countries, if they are concerned about ocean protection, if they want to prioritize the climate, if they want to combat this biodiversity crisis, which in itself is worth combating regardless of the climate. You know, biodiversity crisis by itself is a massive concern, then they need to be coming out with a position against deep sea mining and really doing all they can to stop it from going ahead.
I just want to leave it open to you to talk about anything that we didn't cover that you think people should be aware of or should be looking out for in the months ahead. Is there anything we didn't cover that you think is important?
I would say that it's really important to kind of stress how wide this opposition is. We've got companies, we've got scientists, we've got entire states coming out, we've got financial institutions. I mean, recently, a letter written by 37 financial institutions who represent over 3.3 trillion euros of combined assets signed a letter calling for deep sea mining not to go ahead. The business case for deep sea mining is hanging by a thread, especially when you've got businesses like Samsung and Google and BMW and Volvo and Renault all saying that they're committed to not use metals and minerals extracted from the deep sea in their supply chains. These companies make up a significant part of the potential market for these metals, and it isn't clear that there's going to be a promising enough market for deep sea metals. And so, you know, it's extremely financially risky. And I would also say that another thing to note, which we haven't touched upon in terms of the impacts of deep sea mining, is that it has repercussions for fisheries too. Because obviously these deep sea ecosystems, they make up the foundation of food webs. And we don't really know what the knock-on effects of disrupting these food webs will be. But they could result in the Clarion-Clipperton zone alone, for example, could result in around a 30% loss of food web connection links, which could be really damaging for global fisheries. And when you think about the fact that you've got a lot of local communities, coastal communities dependent on fisheries, then you've got a whole other dimension of environmental justice issues. And I think a really critical study to note was that just recently there was the results of a survey of shrimp and fish populations in an area of a deep sea mining test site off the coast of Japan. And this test took part in 2020. And a year later, there was a 43% decrease in fish and shrimp at the site, and actually worse impacts in the area surrounding this site. There was a 56% reduction in areas surrounding the impact zone. And this is a year later. And this was the impact of mining just a 120-meter strip of the seabed. And the ISA has entered into a total of 31 contracts for exploration, which collectively encompass a total area of around 1.5 million kilometers squared. So, you know, the potential impact on fisheries could be huge. And that's really important to note. And as a result, we've also had a big pushback from a coalition of seafood industry groups, including the Global Tuna Alliance, whose 48 industry partners account for around like 32% of the global tuna trade. They've all expressed opposition to deep sea mining as well, because there's huge concerns that it could disrupt this massive global industry.
That's it for this time. Don't forget, we have a new season launching at the end of this month on the increased criminalization of protest. Make sure you're subscribed so you won't miss those episodes when they start to come out. And in the meantime, we'll see you next week.